Good afternoon. So last time we started talking about control flow integrity, and this is an idea that's related to things we saw with like stack canaries, where we want to like target the place where we have some control flow going to the wrong place, and somehow detect that something's amiss before we actually make a jump we shouldn't make. And unlike how we dealt with stack canaries, we aren't going to kind of hope something gets obviously corrupted, and we aren't going to limit ourselves to just things on the stack. We're going to take places where we have some sort of computed jump and look at where it goes and verify that it goes to a place that is a possibility for where the computed jump is. And the main mechanism we have for doing this is we have our compiler try to figure out what are all the possible places that it could legitimately go to, and have some way of having those all be labeled or otherwise kind of listed as okay, and exclude any other cases. And the hope was that, this would make attacks like return-oriented programming much, much harder. Now, it doesn't precisely prevent those attacks, because what we're preventing is going to a place that isn't possible from this line of code. But when we're determining what's possible, we aren't taking into account the full context of how the program got there. So we can go to, say, a sort function from what function A, and this checking will say, well, that can return to a function B that also calls sort, even though that's not legitimate. And so for this reason, even though as a practical matter, it probably makes it very hard to take advantage of kind of return-oriented programming type things, clearly there are exceptions, and it's not entirely clear exactly how frequent those exceptions are. And probably sort of researchers in this area would argue that for a sufficiently large program, you're likely to be in trouble, even though the attacker has to do a whole lot more work. And we also mentioned that, part of the analysis here is that, there's some complexity in determining where can something return to. One thing is that that's hard to kind of do in advance. In general, the schemes we saw for doing it are kind of relying on us kind of having our program in all its libraries when we produce these labels, or sort of having kind of extra places things can go to that, aren't actually reasonable. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so I looked over quiz answers and I decided I probably should talk about the quiz. So quiz question 1A. We were asking to run a program so it has access to two particular users' home directories, and I should add the important part, and no others. So I think I need to think that's what it is about. Part of the confusion here is that, access to those other home directories isn't especially useful if we can't read files in them, but you can mark files as readable by others in your home directory. The important thing here is that you can't really achieve the end no others without something like the namespacing support, right? If we have files anyone can read in anyone's home directory, that program will be able to read those. Our namespacing, we can set something up where it only has access to specific home directories that the same files it would have access to otherwise, so whatever user it's running at and whatever the host permissions are, but it won't have access to anyone else's home directories if we want to make that happen. So questions on quiz question 1? Okay. So also a quick question 2. So this was asking about address sanitizer. And the key thing that address sanitizer does is it has these checks when we dereference memory. Right. So the way address sanitizer works is that we didn't like actually, you know, check is this index in bounds. Instead, we computed the memory allocation and checked, is that memory location okay? And this meant that we have some cases that we handle more precisely than some of our bounds checking techniques, but often, you know, we end up kind of missing things. And one example is option A. We said we had an array of objects with vtable pointers. And if we think of how that array is going to look, we're going to, you know, the standard layout is that we have array object 0 has a vtable pointer and the other stuff. Array object 1 has a vtable pointer and some other stuff. And there's no empty space that's kind of left there naturally. Like we normally have an array and see the compiler doesn't just add extra space. And the problem is address sanitizer needs some space that will overwrite that is not valid for anything. And since we don't have that, we're not going to be able to detect an overwrite that goes from here to here. Because there's not going to be any place we can add what we call the red zone, that sort of extra invalid area. And if you think of like, well, couldn't we modify the compiler to generate that? Well, the problem is that address sanitizer is trying to not require you to recompile absolutely everything you're using. And if we want to pass this array to a library that isn't compiled with address sanitizer, it has to be laid out the same way. So then option C was asking about what seems like a very similar case, that we have our heap buffer overflow. And here we talked about if we have, I'll do, she's going down, right? We have a list with a next and pref pointer. So we have an object, and before it we have this size, and then we have a size, a next, and a prev, and the other space. We are managing the memory in this way. And we're talking about, well, we have this overwrite where we saw with heap buffers we could do this. And that was useful because this gave us kind of a pointer subterfuge pattern where we overwrote something, you know, when that memory was free. So the thing that address sanitizer and Valgrind Memcheck, and in fact all of these kind of tools do, is because they need to lay out memory in a different way, they replace malloc and free. And since they're replacing malloc and free, even if they're using this strategy for managing the free list, they have the option of inserting kind of a red zone, some space where if there's an overwrite, it will trip the check because we'll like try to check is this a valid location to access and find out no. And we have to replace malloc anyways because otherwise we can't set up our mapping of what parts of memory are valid in the first place. And in this case, there's not a problem with sort of compatibility because any library we're using shouldn't care what's outside of the malloc allocation, right? You shouldn't write code that uses that, so it shouldn't be a problem to change it very slightly. And then we have option D, where we said we access array of X where X is attacker supplied. And here we have the problem that the way address sanitizer works is we have these sort of invalid regions. So for example, if this is our allocation here, if this is array of 0, well, this is some array of X, and we can just skip over that sort of invalid region we used to detect wrong accesses, even though there will be a check for, oh, you're accessing array of X, let me make sure that's valid. It's going to say it's valid because all it's checking is is the memory address we computed by adding array in X actually a memory location that the program should be able to access? It's not. Is it part of the array? We saw fat pointers like in Baggy Bones had a strategy where they asked the question, is it part of the array? Address sanitizer keeps things simpler by not doing that. Questions? Here's question two. Okay. Anything else on the quiz? I don't have slides prepared for anything else, but yes. It's question three, so I need to remember what question three was. So question three is asking, for the fat pointers technique, we discussed in lecture, I probably should have had a slide on question 3C. So this was on the fat pointers technique. So this was the fat pointers technique, kind of our summary is that rather than using a normal pointer, we have this kind of struct where we have, we have a pointer, which is the sort of pointer's actual value, and we have a minimum and a maximum. And the question is asking, do we need extra addition operations when we're adding to a pointer here? And if I have a fat pointer, let's say here versus say my pre this transformation code, right? I'm gonna actually get a pointer which has array of zero here, array of zero here, assuming that's where the array starts, and array of n here, right? So that's what I'm going to get when I translate this C code. And if I compute a new pointer, y, and set that to, say, x plus 10, which, the same thing would be making a pointer y, setting it to x plus 10. This is one arithmetic operation. I'm going to add likely 40 in assembly to the pointer to produce that. Here, my new pointer y, I'm going to have a value of at array 10, and the minimum and maximum I don't need to change. They're just going to be 0 and n. We just leave them as is because the object hasn't moved. When we dereference that, we're going to make sure it's in bounds. But there's no check yet, and I don't need to adjust the minimum and maximum. They're just telling me where the object is. Questions? People look confused. Aren't asking questions, so. And so I'm saying that this is the same addition operation we did here, but for minimum and maximum, we just copy the values. We don't actually have any reason to check until we dereference. And if we are checking, I usually wouldn't call that an addition operation, but we're checking if it's in bounds. Yeah.
I guess I'm still a bit confused on what are the new bounds? Are there addresses?
What are the new bounds? So these bounds are addresses, right? To start out with. And the addresses that are part of the array, which is what this is telling us, don't change when we add to the pointer. Right? the ray is in the same place, and the pointer is telling us, I'm pointing to part of this object, and here's the range at which I can point to.
Okay.
And so the range at which I can point to doesn't change when I do pointer arithmetic. Either the value I compute with the arithmetic is in that range or it's not. But, you know, I don't need to recompute the range. It stays the same as when I initialize the pointer. Question?
If the minimum didn't change on this, if you manipulated y to be x plus 10, would you be able to negative index y?
Question, because the minimum didn't change, would I be able to negative index y? Yes, and that's how C works. So this is something, when implementing this technique, that was important to support, because probably we'll find a C program that deliberately does that. Yeah?
So are there only
question, are there only additional operations when you're checking the bounds? Except, well, there's like the copy here, like, is probably additional operations, but only additional operations are only necessary when we're checking the bounds, and we don't have to do that when we do the arithmetic. We could, but if we did, I don't think that you'd call that an addition operation. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So last time when we finished looking at control flow integrity, mentioned that Clang has this control flow integrity implementation that it optionally supports. Kind of, you can turn it on as a compiler option. And I believe some versions of Chrome have used it in the sort of compiled official version of Chrome on some architectures. And they just decided, you know, to just check vtable calls and function pointers. And if you think about why do they make that decision, well, probably because the return address stuff, that is actually relatively well handled by either stack canaries or shadow stacks. If this is something, but vtable calls and function pointer calls really aren't. And in order to make this work, we need the libraries to kind of be compiled with the support, because remember, part of our analysis is we have to figure out what are all the functions that can be called through this function pointer, and likely libraries are going to be involved somehow in how that's set. And especially since we're probably calling library functions with these function pointers some percentage of the time. So that's, you know, something they have to deal with. And they also wanted to, like, have, you know, not, like, a new calling convention. So they have this strategy where the function pointer or vtable is represented the same way, but we need to have that labeling information. And they looked up the labeling information using either the address of a function or the vtable address. And to make this kind of very fast, because remember, we're doing these checks for every function call of certain sorts. And for like vtable calls, this is very concerning, because if you think of like typical Java programs you've written, it's pretty common for you to call a class method that could be overridden in a loop. And we don't want to make that really slow. So I'll first start with the how they did it for calls through function pointers, because vtables are a little more complicated. But they did this trick to make it simple to look up whether a function was permitted. And also to resolve the question of what do I do if I can call functions A and B here and B and C here? They're like, I can't choose one label for that. So their solution is all the functions that are called through function pointers, you don't get a pointer to the actual function. You get a pointer to one of these stubs. So in this example here, I just have these kind of wrappers here, and I put all the functions that take two arguments that are strings together, because one thing we can say very quickly is that you shouldn't be calling a function with the wrong types. And we're just going to guarantee that whenever you make a pointer to a function, you're going to get one of these wrapper functions. So the first thing we can do is that when you call a function with two string args, the compiler will just check, is the thing you're calling between here and here? If it's not, something's wrong. Some attacker tried to fool us to running a function that wasn't the right type of function, or that we never took a function pointer to. And we can say that's bad. Now, we probably want to be a little more specific with that, because, you know, we don't want to, like, let the attacker convince us to replace our comparison function with a run this command with an argument function. That seems very exploitable. So we will, in addition, store with our function call a bit mask, which will act as our label, but say, which of these functions are you allowed to call? So kind of the code that we'll use is that, say, in our sort implementation, where we're getting a comparison function, we'll round the function pointer to a multiple of 8, you know, make sure it's in the range of valid functions of this type, check if it's on this bit mask, where it is on this bit mask, and make sure that it's one of the sort of functions we've determined can actually happen, right? Which for this mask would be the first and last. So this does have a performance cost, obviously, because these checks, you know, they're more complicated than a function call, but they're relatively cheap. And they, you know, but this kind of idea of setting up the functions kind of be all together, which is something we can do because I don't have dynamically loaded libraries here, you know, makes this pretty efficient. Questions about idea. So this is the idea for kind of normal function pointers, and what they do for vtables is similar, except rather than having these kind of wrapper functions, we just put the vtables all together, and we don't check the address the vtable entry points to, the function addresses, we just check the address of the vtables are in the correct memory. And to make this work correctly, our hope is that all the vtables are constants, meaning that after we load the program, we have that memory region set read-only. But we do a similar check, except rather than checking the actual thing we'll call, we check the place we're getting the pointer where to call is in this range of read-only vtables. And we also have a bit mask to say, what functions could we call here? What vtable entries could be called from here? And why do you say you need a mask? Couldn't we only call one? Well, it turns out that C++ supports pointers to member functions, which I'm not going to talk about how to use them because it's relatively rare, but it supports having cases where you legitimately like call one of several functions in a class. Questions? Okay, so we talked about calling CFI. So let's say I have here an attacker wants to have danger be called. If the attacker can first like write to like arbitrary memory locations that aren't read-only, like don't assume they can just overwrite the code and assume we're doing write x or execute, so you can't like write new shell code and jump to it. what can the attacker, how can the attacker convince us to call danger? Check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what should be going on. Would like some more time? And since this C++, I mentioned this before, but I should probably mention again, this colon public here means inherits for extends. Like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A likely can do it? Okay, how about B? Okay, C? D? And E? Three people? No clue? Okay, and let's do the alternate version. Without CFI or similar. Who thinks A could do it? We don't have CFI. Who thinks we could make A? So we don't have, if we just don't do the CFI thing, who thinks A could potentially end up calling danger? Thinks yes, no, no clue. Okay, so let's think about if we can write to arbitrary memory locations, if there's no CFI, I just set pointer equal to danger, and I don't care that there's an argument being passed. That makes sense. So without CFI, A would be a thing that could do this. How about B? Who thinks B could do it without CFI? Okay, for same reason. With B, we could also set it equal to G. Okay, how about C? Who thinks C could do it without CFI? Who thinks C could not do it? No clue. Okay, so let's talk about here, we're getting, this could be, so this is gonna give us a pointer to an object that is a foo, but it could be, so, but the compiler doesn't know that there isn't a new subclass of foo which has a new vtable. So we could do it with C, and the way we do it as an attacker is that we return an object where we had, in the vtable slot, we had something that pointed to an array that had, it had a slot for what f was, and that would point to the danger function in the program. And so that object, it would look like a foo object when the function ran, and in a foo object, we want to figure out how do we call the f method? It would say, well, we look up in the vtable where the f method is implemented, it would say it's implemented in danger. So we could absolutely do it for C. And the same is true for D, because we could hypothetically have a subclass of Quux that has a different F method. The compiler needs to worry about that. And therefore would support that if we don't do some CFI, some check, that the vtable is actually valid. Yeah?
What if we did the same thing for
bar? What if we did the same thing for bar?
Yeah, would that work?
What do you mean the same thing?
Like, as in, well, you have a pointer to the to foo and then a pointer to qu ux, but if there's also, like, a bar also extends from foo, but it already has an implementation of
that. Oh, the question is, could we override bar? The same thing is true here, yes. So these aren't final. So something labeled as virtual in C means it's not what Java would call final. So we could have a subclass of this. That means the code that would normally be generated that uses foo or quux is going to all, or bar, all of them is going to assume there might be a subclass.
Even though it's implemented, you can still override it.
Yeah, just like in Java, you know, if you have a non-final method, you can still override it. That same thing is true here. So unless the compiler somehow knows there's no subclasses of bar and quux, the compiler has to assume that it could have been overridden. Does that answer your question? So it does happen to be the case that if I make the word virtual on my implementations in bar and quux, that the compiler's that's equivalent to marking something as final in Java. Well, kind of equivalent. So the compiler would be allowed to assume there's no subclass, but that's not something we've done here. Okay. So how about with CFI? And I would say, I think the best answer is E here, if we have CFI. The sketchiest case, the case we'd be most concerned about, is probably B, maybe A. And the issue is we don't have enough context here to know how specific the compiler is about knowing what could possibly be assigned to pointer, right? So if the compiler knows that G is the only thing, H is the only thing that ever pointer ever gets set to, then it can make A and B not possible. But if the compiler can't prove, you know, or thinks that there's some way that, say, H, that pointer could get set to G, then obviously B would be possible. If the compiler, if there's other functions out there, then obviously B would be possible. And the other thing that's related to that that might be a concern is that for here, this is assuming no other subclasses. That if there's other subclasses of foo, even if they're not in this code snippet, the compiler probably allows them to be called. Right, so we actually have to think, we actually might need more context. You need to know, oh, are there any other subclasses of foo that we could call, and what does that mean? Because probably when we do the check, the compiler's gonna not have done the analysis to know that's not a possible class that could be used here, and maybe it's not even, there's more. So questions? Here. So that's on CFI. So let's talk, we talked about kind of this nice, you know, somewhat slow implementation CFI that's not used much. Let's talk about two things of things that are like actually well supported in hardware, or kind of well supported in hardware, that are trying to do the same idea and maybe more commonly deployed in software. So one of them, I'll just talk briefly, is using NBR64. So NBR64 is Intel's control flow enforcement. And it's basically this control flow integrity idea, but rather than having labels that are different for every type of function we call, we just have one label. Is this a function we can call or not? And that label is placed by putting the NBR64 instruction where we can call or jump to, like a jump as in like a switch statement. The idea of this is that even though this is kind of way less, it prevents a lot less than kind of the Clang's control flow integrity implementation does, but you know, this is pretty simple to implement in hardware and in compilers, and it already makes return-oriented programming and things like that a lot, and jump-oriented programming a lot harder, right, if we can, because we have to jump to a real function or switch statement entry point. And ARM has a similar feature. They just use a different name for some reason of branch target identification. But it's the same idea. So ARM has one other interesting feature, which is authenticated pointers. And to give an idea of what this might look like is, rather than using as yet another alternative to stack canaries, let's say I generate a message authentication code using a secret key. And at the end of my function, I make sure that my pointer, my return address, you know, has a MAC tag that matches that message authentication code. So I'm effectively getting something like a digital signature on the return address when I start the function and making sure that digital signature checks out before I end the function. And if we can actually keep this secret key secret, then this is better than stack canaries. Because it doesn't matter if you change the authentication code, you can't make it correct for a different return address unless you know the secret key. And we can actually make this a little better. So a problem with that scheme I had there is that, well, once you sign the return address, like you could use that elsewhere. We can prevent that too by kind of including in the thing we sign the stack pointer value. So then you have to use it for that stack location. You can't take a return address from one function and use it for another. And you might say, well, this seems kind of expensive. The idea we're going to see with this technique is that we're going to have hardware help for two parts of this. One piece of hardware help is we're going to have special registers holding keys, holding this, that can't be read. And that means that the hardware will also provide this MAC operation. And that the hardware's implementation of MAC operation can read the secret key, but normal code can't. And so this makes it really hard for an attacker, even an attacker who can read all our memory, to actually get at the secret key, and therefore forge any valid return address now. And the kind of the actual format that this probably takes is that we basically kind of encode our return address at the beginning of the function and decode it later. And that decoding operation will crash, you know, like a seg fault, basically, if it's invalid. And you notice something we're doing here is that the encoded value here now contains both the authentication code and the real return address. And there's going to be some compromises to make that happen, but this means that we can kind of fit it in the same place we normally put the return address. And I'm showing this for return address pointers, but we can apply this to other types of pointers. So we can, for example, have our vtable pointers be authenticated in the same way. That when the vtable is set up, we sign the vtable entries with a secret key. And a label which might say like which function it is. And then now an attacker who doesn't know the secret key can't make the vtable entry point somewhere else because if we read a vtable entry the attacker produced, it won't sort of decode correctly. So ARM 64 actually implements this idea, and they keep the secret key in some special register. Actually, they have several of these keys, so they have several special registers. And on 64-bit ARM, typically you aren't using all 64 bits of the address, so they use the upper bits of the pointer address to store the message authentication code. And have this picture from paper on it. So they take our pointer address, and this instruction that signs a pointer produces a value with our authentication code in the upper bits of the pointer. And you have to sort of verify that signature before you actually use it. And another handy thing for like error detection here is because we've put something in the upper bits of the pointer is invalid now until we verify the signature. So we can't accidentally dereference this. And so with this technique, you know, we can have kind of the same kind of idea as control flow integrity, that we kind of label our pointers as like return address or vtable entry of this type. We can have separate keys for different types of things and mixing that information like stack pointers or function signatures to make it so, you know, we're checking not only is the pointer value actually a vtable entry, is it one like for a function of the foo class? And so these kind of, as I said, solve similar problems, and they're not a complete solution. And the big reason is that just like with CFI, we could mix up things that are labeled the same way with pointer authentication. We can still use the wrong signed pointer if it's signed in the correct way, like calling the wrong method of a class, calling the method of a wrong subclass, I should say, for example. Also, as we'll talk about, there have been problems with, like, since we're signing these things at runtime, sometimes we don't prevent the attacker from having something like ROP that jumps to the signing code, and that obviously is bad. But this is, like, actually used. And most notably, Apple uses it for their software. Their version of Clang supports compiling with it on, but they don't support distributing applications compiled this way. So, or have libraries that use it, and it changes the calling convention. That's a big problem, right? We have a whole new calling convention if we want to actually use this for like vtables and function pointers and things like that. And I've seen some proposals to use it on Linux. I'm not sure if anyone actually turns it on, but for example, there's an option in the current Linux linkers for 64-bit ARM, which would use it for the global offset table. So remember how we could overwrite the global offset table to point to somewhere else? Well, with this technique, if you try to do that, now the pointer signature is verified, and oops, the thing you overwrote it to just crashes the program. And Apple happily documents sort of how they use this pointer authentication. You can see that they kind of, they have their secret key, and it's kind of the extra info that's checked. So you see they use this technique for verifying return addresses, that the return addresses are signed with where they're stored on the stack. Function pointers are signed with a different key, so you can't choose a if you get a function pointer, you can't use it as a return address, even if it's signed correctly. And for vtable entries, they're signed and they add in the information about where in the vtable is it and what method is it calling. What method name is it calling? So that has to be right. And they have sort of this idea. And also they also do the same for vtable pointers. So vtable pointers are signed. So you can't replace a vtable pointer unless you, you know, with a random pointer, because you can't get a signed pointer that signed the right way. And you might say, okay, so this means that Apple hasn't had any of these kind of pointer thugs. Nope. So why has this not made it so iOS and hasn't had any jailbreaks that involve pointer bugs? Well, because, you know, this is not foolproof in practice. So one thing is, not all code pointers ended up being authenticated. Other thing is, there's lots of timing issues. Because we're signing things at runtime, often there were bugs where, especially with multiple cores, you could change pointers just before they were signed from another core and get a signed pointer, because the code needed to sign the pointer to make the function pointer, the vtable or whatever. And oops, now you have a signed pointer to the wrong thing. Or similarly, we just have code that you could just call that signed a pointer, added to a pointer that was signed. So it decrypted, sort of removed the signature, added the signature, and they had a bug where they removed the signature without verifying it was correct. Oops. Or the other thing is that if you think about, so if you know a little about cryptography, you might know that a typical message authentication code is like at least 96-ish bits. And our pointers are 64 bits, and we're using like the bottom 40 of them for like the actual address. So there's not actually enough space for a secure message authentication code. So this means that you could actually brute force the signature if you have enough trials. And that's kind of something that's really hard to avoid, because, you know, we don't want to make our pointers like 128 bits. You know, the kind of, this is predicated on an attacker typically won't be able to do like 2 to the 32 trials to see if a pointer is right. But that's not necessarily true in practice. So that's where we'll finish up today. So next time we'll, and probably Friday, we'll talk about some web stuff.